This is Sarah Reith with Promise of Paradise, Back to the Land, Oral Histories of Mendocino County. We'll be airing it this time on Thursdays for the foreseeable future. We'll start with Prue Wilcox, whose story of being a newcomer to elk in the Back to the Land era is really iconic.
My name is Prue Wilcox, and I've lived here in Elk for about 35 years, and I'll let you know how I got here. My husband and I and our five children lived in Walnut Creek. Each year we took a little vacation. Usually we went to Monterey or Carmel, and we had never been up north. So we decided to come to the Mendocino area, and at the last minute I couldn't come. And he brought a couple of the kids. They came up, and Sunday afternoon he came back and he said, "You better sit down, Prue." And I said, "Why?" He said, "Because I bought a home without your seeing it." And I said, "Oh, you wouldn't do anything like that." And he said, "Well, if I hadn't known our marriage was that strong, I never would have done it." And I thought to myself, what can I say? I can't say our marriage isn't that strong. But I said, "Okay, it'll be your house. You do what you want with it." But about 4 days later, I was so curious. I said, "When are we going up to our new house?" And he knew he had gotten me. So when we first made the first trip up to Elk, I was hooked. I never wanted to leave. I just loved it here. It took us about 10 years to get the place fixed up enough to live in. It was right on the ground. It had to be lifted up, new foundation put under it. We loved it, but there were some things that we really had to get used to. I kept telling Del, "We have moved to a different place." Oh, about 4 or 5 months after we got the place, I was upstairs and I looked out. There were balloons everywhere next door and all kinds of confetti and everything. And here was this gentleman. He had the Bible and he had a morning coat on, and he was marrying this young couple, very nice looking young couple. So about 4 months later, I remembered that. And I asked somebody in town, "What happened to that nice young couple that I saw getting married next door?" "Oh," they said, "oh, they've broken up, and the minister is living with the bride." Well, I turned to my husband and I said, "You see, I told you, we have moved to a different place." Not too awfully long after that, the two daughters were up for the weekend with us, and we were down at the beach. And all of a sudden, here comes this young man in his 20s, and he had this big basket. And he proceeded to take all his clothes off, and he started this dance all around this basket without a thing on. We walked as far down the beach as we could, but then we looked up and here he was standing in front of us saying, "I hope I haven't gotten you all upset at all." We had to avert our eyes, but we told him, "Oh, it's perfectly all right. Go ahead with your dance." He said, "It's to my newborn son." I couldn't think of any gift to give him better than to dance free on the beach around him. So after he had gone back to his dance, I turned to my husband and I said, "Don't you see? I told you, we've moved to a different place." Another time, we heard that there was going to be a big meeting at the school here. It was about putting in a salmon hatchery down in Elk Creek. There was supposed to be people coming from all over the place protesting and salmon fishermen that were the sport fishermen, they were coming to speak highly of this idea. Anyway, I went to this meeting, and I came in the door, and right on the floor was this lady, pregnant as she could be, and her husband was massaging her back. And this went on for quite a while, and people, the room filled up, and they got up and went into the kitchen. And the meeting started. All of the people were representing their side. And all of a sudden, we heard this baby crying and crying. The lady had had her baby, and she came out to the meeting with the baby in a blanket, and she had all of her documents that she wanted to present, and she proceeded to present them. The next day, I called my husband, and I said, "We haven't moved to a different place. We've moved to a different planet. But I've loved this planet so much and have lived here for so long. And my husband passed in 95, but he knew that he had left me in the best place he could possibly leave me."
So what did you do when you came here?
I joined everything I could. The Civic Club. And then they have the auxiliary to the fire department. They have auxiliaries to everything that you can imagine. My kids all wanted me to come back to the Bay Area. And then they were up one weekend and they saw how everybody stopped, gave me a hug and said, "You know, we've got you under our wings. You're not going to be alone here in Elk." So the kids knew that this was the place I should be. And I've really been happy here. I've learned a lot of the history. And we had a wonderful docent that she started, actually, the museum. She would tell me these stories, and she would say, "Now, Prue, that's just between us, because a lot of these families, their loved ones are still living, and they wouldn't want this out." So I respected that, and I kept that. And one day, I was in there, in the museum, and this young man came in, and he said, "Do you have anything on the Croce family?" And I remembered we had a big folder on them in the archives. And I said, "Oh, yes, we do." I said, he said, it's the one about the man shooting his wife at the local hotel bar." And I said, "Oh, yes, that's the one." I said, "He was jealous. He thought she was having an affair with the other bartender. And so he shot her. And then he ran up to the water tower. And a posse found him right away and took him, tried him immediately, and took him to San Quentin, where they waited for them to get 14 witnesses. And then they hung him. And this was, we had papers, a newspaper articles and everything about it. And one of the gentlemen in town, his father was one of the witnesses to this hanging. But anyway, the fellow said, "Well, could I copy some of this, what you have here in the archives?" I said, "Yes." He said, "I'll give you some of the information I have." He said, "This was my grandfather and grandmother." He said, "I never knew about it until the night before I was married." And I said, "Well, that must have been a terrible shock." He said, "It was." He said, "Then I started collecting information about it." And I said, "Well, what do you plan to do with this, all this information?" He said, "I'm going to write a bestseller." At that time, the docent who had told me not to ever say anything about anything like this, she had passed, but I said, and it doesn't happen all the time. Some people do want to know about what happened to their families.
So when you came to Elk, did you do any kind of homesteading or gardening or anything like that?
We had a garden in the back. Our little place was about 120 years old when we got it. So we spent a lot of time just fixing it up so we could live in it. And it was built by the lumber company. That was how this town was built, to be a lumber town. Mine was built for the doctors who practiced their medicine next door to where it was the hospital.
Did you have to work?
No, I didn't. No, we had really retired. Well, I was always into volunteering because taking care of the five children, it was a big job. But by the time we moved up here permanently, the kids were all grown practically. And so at the very beginning of our trek up to Elk, we brought my youngest daughter, who was about 11 years old. She brought her best friend up from Walnut Creek for the weekend. And there were two little girls living next door. So I said, you run over there and see the girls, make friends next door, and you all can have some fun. They could show you around and let you know what's going on in Elk for kids your age. So they did. They went next door, and they came back, and my daughter Juliet said, Mom, you wouldn't believe it. The 10-year-old said, oh, we're awfully sorry that we can't offer you any pot, but we've smoked up our weekly allowance. And I said, I can't believe it either. And I said, I turned to her little friend, and I said, Susie, you don't want this to leave Elk, and you don't want it to get down to Walnut Creek. Well, next thing I knew, Susie's mother called and said, Susie won't be going up to Elk anymore. We heard about Elk. So that was one of the first things we learned about Elk. And not long after that, we would go down the street and people would offer us tokes and even a whole cigarette. But we got used to that. I think we realized that we were going to meet up with the hippies and their alternative lifestyle. If somebody was in trouble, my goodness gracious, everyone in town, the old folks and the hippies, and they all just came forward and did as much as they could to help someone. They still do. That's the way they are here in Elk. Elk has really changed so much, because when we first came up, it was occupied by a lot of the hippies that had come up from the Bay Area, and they were all into just doing anything that they could. So we had them working on our house quite a bit. But now it's gotten to be kind of a resort. When this place is finished down the street, it will be like a resort, but nice resort.
Now we'll shift gears and hear from Anne Scirocco, who lived in a canvas yurt in the Mendocino National Forest from June 1979 to July 1995. The property you'll hear about has burned twice. Once in the Forks Fire of 96, when three cabins were saved. It burned again this year in the ranch fire. She told me in an email yesterday that all the structures and most of the trees are ash and trash. There's nothing left. Where were you when you decided to come into the country and do a back to the land trip?
Oh, we were living in Mill Valley. Somebody came up north for, I think they went to Crabtree Hot Springs, as a matter of fact, and on the way back picked up one of those newspaper flyers that gets stuffed in your mailbox and saw someone was trying to sell this piece of property in the Mendocino National Forest. And that's how we ended up there. We bought that property.
How far away is that from a town?
Was 45 minutes in second gear and about 2,000 feet elevation. So there was a Japanese couple and my family and an American couple from Mill Valley who had two children.
So what were you expecting when you moved into the forest?
Oh, I don't know. I'd had this camping experience when I lived in New York City. So I lived in Alphabet City in New York City. There were no trees. You know, it was just like concrete and buildings, six-story buildings. And I went with some friends up to Bear Mountain State Park and camped. And then Monday morning, we got up really early and we broke camp and we went to work. And I thought, this is it. This is what I want to do. So it just seemed to evolve. It took about 8-9 years. It just evolved. So I just wanted to be camping. And so that's what I did for 16 years.
What kind of work did you do before you went camping?
Well, I worked for a publisher and I worked for a sewing pattern company. And I did a bunch of temp work. And I just, you know, New York City wasn't really the thing for me. Then I moved to Boston and I got almost finished a master's in education, but didn't like practice teaching. So I decided I wasn't going to do that. And I did some work for the city of Boston for a while.
So what were some of your first impressions when you moved into the forest?
I don't know. You know, 3 weeks later, I had a baby. I didn't have time for impressions. So we were happy that the rattlesnakes didn't come through the yurt.
So you were 8.5 months pregnant when you moved into the forest?
I was.
Did you have a home birth?
I did. It was great.
With a midwife or your husband attending? Or
the mountain was a psychiatrist. So he was, you know, he was a doctor. And so he was marginally helpful. I mean, the most helpful thing he did for me was say, around midnight, say, this baby is not going to be born until morning. And I thought, I am not doing this all night. So my attitude changed from, oh, this hurts, to, come on, baby. And then it was an hour and a half later he was born. So, you know, it's like attitude was everything.
Was that the only home birth you had?
No, I had two more.
So what was that like being pregnant out in the forest?
Just being pregnant. You know, it's like you keep doing the same things. You keep cooking, washing, you know, carrying water. I don't like to carry water, but you do it. You know, garden, get firewood. You know, I never had a thing about, you know, I have to have this kind of food. That seemed irrelevant to me. That never came up for me. I know for many women, they have food urges, and I've got to have pickles and ice cream or whatever, but that wasn't that my experience.
Did you have any kind of prenatal care or just... So you said that you had a garden and you built yurts. Did you already have building skills?
We made canvas yurts. We made those before we went up. And I have a little teeny Singer sewing machine, and we did half the sewing on that. So we made three of them at one time and then went up and put them up. So when my older son was born, we barely had walls. I mean, the walls were up and we put the roof up, but I don't think we put up the walls yet. But it was cool. I mean, you know, I mean, comfortably cool. You know, the breeze come. We're on a hillside and in the evening the breeze is coming up. So it was actually lovely.
What kind of housing and shelter situation did you have to come up with when it got cold?
We stayed in the yurt. So at first we didn't have a wood stove, and that you know, my husband had lived in a teepee in the Sierras, so he was used to that. But you can control rain better in a teepee than you can in a yurt. So then we bought three wood stoves from a guy in Willits named Kirk. I don't even know what his first. I still have that stove in the mountains. It says Kirk on it. He put his name on it for us. These wonderful little airtight stoves, and then you know you do with a stove. And then we also used a Japanese country technology called a kotatsu, which is you take embers out of the fire and put them into a clay pot. So we were on a dirt floor. So we dug a hole in the middle of the dirt floor and had a little table over that. And you could sit on the floor at that table and put your feet down in the bottom. And in the middle was a clay pot and it was filled with embers. And then over the table, you put a quilt. and then a tabletop on top of that. And keeps you really warm. I have one now. It's electric now, but it's the same thing. It's very popular in Japan. The old style was dug in with charcoal or embers or cinders, whatever.
How did you get the idea to do that?
You know, they're all over in Japan. Everybody in Japan, I don't know anymore. They didn't used to have central heating, so everybody had now an electric kotatsu. But if you went to a countryside to an old farmhouse, that's what they were doing. That's how they stayed warm.
Have you been to Japan? Is that where you learned?
Oh, no, my husband knew about it, so I didn't. He was Japanese, so I didn't need to learn about it. But, yeah, that's where I first said, oh, this is really great. I like this. There's lots of jokes about how if you go into the kotatsu, you never come out. Too comfortable.
How long did your yurts last?
They were still there, and so we were there for 16 years. The roof was okay, but we painted the roof. We put house paint on the roof because it leaked. It was supposed to be water resistant, not so much. And then we realized that if we weren't going to move it, we could just paint it.
So, what were some other homesteading skills that you had to learn or figure out?
I don't know about figure out. I mean, I had to learn how to cook on charcoal and on wood. I'd never done that before. And wood is, well, it's messy, but it's pretty easy. But, you know, I got pretty good at cooking on charcoal. And the Kirk stove, the way it was designed, you could put a whole turkey in there overnight. And then in the middle of the night, if you took it out and added some more cinders, we'd save all our embers in a closed pot on bricks, not on, if you put that closed pot on wood, you'll start a fire and burn your house down. We would save all our cinders or embers until they were cinders. And then if you needed to restoke your fire, you just threw them in. Then we had a blowing stick to blow air on it to heat it up faster. We incorporated a lot of Japanese traditional technology, and it was a great lifestyle. I really loved it.
So did you get the ideas from your husband and the Japanese couple that was on the property with you?
Well, they didn't stay very long. They decided that they had other things they wanted to do, so they went back and he became a millionaire. So, you know. They had other things to do, but other people came. So we had a lot of people came to visit us from Japan and other places, and they would bring ideas. So we didn't really have a really good way to bathe for a while, and then a new friend showed up from Japan and said, "Whoa, you just put a 55-gallon drum on a fire and heat it up, and it's fabulous. You know, you're in water up to your neck. It's hot. There's a wooden rack under your feet. You don't burn your feet. You can control the temperature by adding more wood or adding cold water. Night sky."
What about figuring out how to feed yourselves?
Well, you know, we shopped at the co-op. We were members of the co-op from almost, I don't know at the beginning because I don't know when they started, but from 1979. And so you'd get a 50-pound bag of rice and a 50-pound bag of flour, and you get salt, and you get a 25-pound bag of beans, and then you learn how to do stuff. You learn how to make tempeh, and you learn how to make tofu, and you learn how to make miso. And we didn't get a whole lot. I'd always say I need a box of raisins, but I was the only sugarholic in the family. So you could make bread and you could cook rice, and there was garden in the is easy. Winter gardens were fabulous. You know, you'd start them mostly in August, and then you know you had big daikon, and if there was snow, that they'd be protected and they wouldn't freeze, and you just pop them out. We buy potatoes and onions too, because we had very rocky, we're on a slope, so we had a lot of very rocky soil. All our topsoil was down in Upper Lake.
So what about livestock or chickens?
We had chickens. My younger son particularly loved his, what do you call him, chicken lumps or something like that, his lumpies. we didn't eat them, we ate their eggs, but we didn't eat the chickens.
So what about educating kids? How do you raise your kids so far away from town?
Oh, that was my job, you know, so we homeschooled until my older boy was 16, and then he wanted to go to regular school, and it was getting too much for me, because I had somebody in high school, somebody in middle school, and somebody in elementary school who didn't really want to read. It was getting really complicated for me, so it was kind of hard to find materials at that point. You know, one time I tried to buy curriculum from somebody, and I forget how much money it cost, and I got this thing, it's like four books. I said, I don't think so. You know, it's like, you know, I'm not getting any benefit from this. And then we found a local school district that would loan us books. It was a little bit tricky to get and what are they supposed to be learning? I had no idea. So we just kind of faked it. Learn how to read. Here's some math. You know, my older son was, he never learned algebra, because I don't remember algebra. And But he was really good at geometry because of somebody lived there with us for a while who had been a surveyor, and he taught him geometry, practical geometry, not writing theorems. A lot of what would happen is that different people would live there and teach the kids different things too. So in addition to my trying to fill in the blanks. And they loved to read, so they were just voracious readers.
Do you remember how they amused themselves?
Oh, God, yeah, they just went. They went off, they just leave, you know, and go do whatever they were going to do. What was they like to play? They like to play Othello. It's a Japanese board game they like to play, but and do puzzles. But mostly, they were just out eating germs, you know, in the dirt, dirty children, running around barefoot and crazy and wild and... My daughter was saying that she and her older brother had made a whole, sounds like it was so, oh my God, dangerous. But they'd made all, on the hillside above us, there was a lot of brush land, and they'd made all these tunnels and secret getaways in the brush land. I have no idea.
You said that a lot of people would come and teach kids how to do anything. Was there a sense of community among the people who were sharing the experience with you?
Yeah, sure. I mean, at different times there were, sometimes just my family was there. Sometimes there were four families there. It just kept changing. People would come for a while and then they'd say, I don't know, maybe this isn't what I want to do. Maybe this is for later or whatever, you know. So yeah, everybody brought different skills to the table.
What were your interactions like with the people who were already in the community, like in the town? Did you associate with people who already lived there?
I didn't go to town very much. So lots of time, especially when we were first there, we had one old truck and there just wasn't much room for people to travel together. So I didn't have a whole lot of contact with town with people who lived in town. But I'd hear the rumors later, you know, people would say, oh, are you the people who have the farm in the mountains? She's got a farm, we got four chickens. He's got a farm. No. Oh, we want to bring our nursery school up to visit your farm. We don't have a farm. No. And the stories about that, we hear the stories about the hippies in the mountains, you know, the crazy stories. Are they talking about us? You know, we're just living up here, you know. It's like, it was very funny. There was nobody else living around us. It was very different from the Greenfield feeling where there's lots of people living, you know, doing their thing close by. There was nobody. There were maybe Cobb Mountain had intentional communities, but they tended to be spiritual. Yeah, we'd have Rajneeshis come by too. Oh, good Lord. not him himself, but his people, you know, they're just orange. Anyway, there were other spiritual communities on Cobb, but they weren't around us. There was nobody else up there.
So why did you eventually come back to town?
My older son wanted to go to school. After the Kobe earthquake, he got an airplane ticket and went to Kobe to help. He was 17 then. And he said, well, I'll come back if I can go to school. And I kind of wanted him to come back. I thought that would be a good idea.
Is there a particular memory of that time that's especially emblematic of the experience for you?
No, but I can say that I have lines now that I draw in terms of living. If I were go back and live out in the countryside, way out in the mountains again, that I want the water to run in and I want it to run out. I can take the temperature, but I don't want to carry water in or I don't want to carry water out. And I want one light. Because if you hear some crazy loud noise at night and you wonder what it is, you really want to be able to flip one switch and not have to look around for a lighter to light kerosene or to do some kind of other, you know, like a process just to get some light to see what's going on, particularly if you have babies. I mean, it's just like one light.
You've been listening to Promise of Paradise, Back to the Land, Oral Histories. We just heard from Prue Wilcox of Elk and Ann Scirocco of Elk Valley, which burned recently in the ranch fire. There is an Elk Valley GoFundMe page where you can see pictures and read some really beautiful writing about the community of Japanese hippies and beatnik veterans who lived there. Keep an eye out for the Promise of Paradise webpage coming soon to kzyx.org. There we'll have longer versions of our interviews, full transcripts, and eventually some pictures of our own. Promise of Paradise is supported by the National Endowment for the Humanities, California Humanities, the Arts Council of Mendocino County, the Judy Pruden Historical Preservation Fund of the Community Foundation of Mendocino County, the Mendocino Institute, and Grace Hudson Museum.
There's something happening here. what it is ain't exactly clear.